talk about how to compute energy levels in SU engaged theories for flux tubes in SU engaged theories using the thermodynamic data ansatz and why it all works. Okay, so let's start from the beginning. The first question is, what are the strings we consider, or the strings I'll be talking about? And everything I talk about applies to any string like excitation in a relativistic quantum field theory. This might be good enough for a lot of people. Just in case you want something more concrete, I'll give you two examples. The first example are flux tubes in SU engaged theories. I'll assume that there's no dynamical quark, so it's a pure glue theory. Otherwise, if I make it too long, the flux tube will just break. I work in four dimensions, and formally, I'll work in the large n limit because I'm ignoring interactions that in principle are there where the flux tube can emit a glue ball and reabsorb the glue ball. I ignore those. Okay, so what are these flux tubes? So in this pure glue theory, what you can do is you can put a quark, a heavy quark somewhere over here, and a heavy anti-quark somewhere over there, and you separate them by some distance r, and you ask, what does this configuration look like? Where is the energy density localized? And you find that if you separate them by some distance r that's large compared to some characteristic scale, say the QCD scale, then this looks effectively like a string, and this one, you would say, looks like an open string. On the lattice, you can also look at closed strings. What I mean by closed strings in practice is, on the lattice, all your directions are compactified. You can make one much smaller than the others, and you can put the flux around that compact direction, or in practice, you have a Wilson line around that compact direction, and you get a solution or a configuration that looks like this, and this looks like a closed string. Okay. The second example that I'm sure everyone knows is the strings in an Abelian-Higgs model, or the ANO string, the Abrikosov-Nielsen-Olesen string. So for this, you should consider a complex scalar field that's coupled to a U1 gauge field and has this Mexican hat potential. And then there are solutions that I'm sure you all know where the scalar field, say, far out in that direction, sits somewhere here at the bottom of the potential, which I'll indicate by these arrows. So it has some VEF and a certain direction in field space. And as you go around, once the phase of your VEF changes by 2 pi, so you see that you've created some defect here. As you go to the center, the VEF has to get smaller and smaller. At the center, it vanishes, so the scalar field sits on top of the hill. The symmetry is restored, and you see that you've stored some little bit of energy density here, and this is extended along the c direction, which looks like a string. So those are two examples. Any other example that you can come up with of string-like objects in a relativistic quantum field theory also described by this. In principle, there's also examples that you can think about in non-relativistic theories. A lot of what we say still applies there, but this really helps you a lot because it has much more symmetries. So I will really make a lot of use of the fact that it's a relativistic quantum field theory. So the next question is, what would we like to know about them? And the answer is that we would like to understand the energy spectra, or the spectrum of excitations on these strings. And here what I'm showing is an example for SU3 in four dimensions. And this is the data from this paper from 2010, which I think is the most recent on these kind of calculations. And you see, to me, this data is very impressive. The error bars are very small. This is the ground state. Then the orange one you see kind of has a little bit of a rise here. This is, you can recognize, as something that goes like 2 pi over r. This means there's one left moving quantum in this state. So here you just see the momentum. Here's another one that just rises, again has two left movers on the world sheet. Then there are states like this blue one that don't have this rise. Those are states where you have a left and a right mover, and you don't have any free particles because they have some binding energy. And then this state, I'll hopefully get to say more about toward the end. Okay. So Here, these, I haven't yet said, I guess, what the different points are, but these have different spins and different parity properties. So this one is the ground state has spin zero and parity plus plus. So there's the world sheet parity and space-time parity. This is zero plus plus. This one has spin one. That's the only one with spin one in this plot. This one has spin two. And then this one is zero minus minus. And this is another one that could have mixed with the ground state, but it doesn't because they're separated. Well, no, this is because it doesn't go like 1 over r because you have a tachyon, essentially. So the ground state, so there's some place where, in fact, it doesn't make sense anymore. So this you can interpret if you want as deconfinement. But if you make this thing too small, this is a bosonic string, so you know there's a tachyon at small r, so it doesn't go like 1 over r. I'll have more to say about this later because it is interesting that it doesn't go like 1 over r. Yeah, now here you just essentially here you just see that it goes linearly in at large r, and then at small r, eventually there's some critical radius where it just goes to zero. Okay, so the next question is why should there be a single effective theory for different kinds of long strings? And the first thing one might point out is that the typical excitations are of order 1 over LS, which is, say, the QCD scale. But there are massless excitations whose energies go like 1 over r because of Goldstone's theorem. I'll explain that later in the, on the next slide a little better, even though this may already be obvious to most people. But for if you just look at the expressions for now, you will notice that for long strings, the energy levels coming from the Goldstone modes are lower than the massive states. Okay, so if you only want to understand the low-lying energy levels, you have to only understand the dynamics of the Goldstone bosons. Now, why are there these Goldstone bosons? What are they? I'll just show it to you in pictures. I think it's fairly clear. So say you have a long string like this, then you can just translate it in the transverse directions. And these two configurations obviously have the same energy because your theory was translationally invariant. This means that the transverse directions don't have a mass. Otherwise, it would have costed you some energy to translate the guy. So these transverse directions are massless. And then what you can also do is you can translate it by a different amount up here and down here. So you build up gradients, and those gradients cost you energy. And the gradient energy for a massless scalar just goes like 1 over r squared. And then you integrate over the size of the string, which gives you r. So the energy from these gradients go like 1 over r. So these transverse modes of the string are the Goldstone modes that we'll write the effective field theory for. Now, generically, this is all you expect. So you expect only these Goldstone degrees of freedom to be massless. You could imagine that the string breaks other symmetries, that it doesn't just break translation invariance, it could also break supersymmetry. In that case, you would get an effective superstring. There could be other symmetries that you're breaking, but generically, it's a good assumption that only the Goldstone degrees of freedom are massless. And this is nice because their action is largely fixed by the symmetry breaking pattern. So you break the Poincaré symmetry of your spacetime to the Poincaré symmetry on the world sheet, cross the rotations in the transverse directions. And okay, we already said the Xi's must appear derivatively coupled because they're Goldstone bosons. The action must be world sheet Poincaré invariant, and it must be invariant under rotations in the transverse directions. And obviously, we're not the first ones to point these things out. There's a lot of both old papers by Lüscher from 81 and also recent papers by Aharoni and collaborators from the last few years. This means that the action has to take this form. So it's Poincaré invariant, the indices are contracted, the SOD minus 2 invariance you see here, and it appears only with derivatives. So you get your kinetic term. Then for four axis, four derivatives, you can have kinetic term squared, or you can have this one where the indices are contracted in different ways, so the flavor indices are contracted in a different way from the derivatives. Then you can have higher twist operators if you want, so where you have more derivatives than x's. Here, for instance, you could have one with two x's, four derivatives, or here, the one I'm writing, you have four x's and six derivatives. And this was what was used for a while for some reason, but this it's clear that you're also breaking the boost, so the action you write down also has to nonlinearly realize the broken boosts, and you see that this is very powerful. So this is where Lorentz invariance or the relativistic string really enters, because you can see that if you want to nonlinearly realize these boosts, then you get, from here, you get a cubic piece from plugging this into the variation. Here you also get a cubic piece from plugging this in, and the two have to cancel. So you see that C2 and C3 will be related to this coefficient. And at the end of the day, if you respect all the symmetries, then the action becomes very simple. It's just the leading term becomes the Nambu-Goto action. I write it in this form where this is the induced metric on the string, and I work in static gauge. So just for convenience, I wrote it like this. But really everything I've done so far was explicitly in static gauge. And so this is the leading piece, just the area of the string. And then you can add higher derivative operators. So this is the extrinsic curvature squared. I didn't define them, but if anyone wants me to define them, I'm happy to define them, but you don't really have to know what they are because they will appear at very high order. But one thing you see is that there's not just one invariant that I could have written, but there were really two. I could have also written K alpha beta squared. The reason you only have to write one is because these two are related to the Ricci scalar by the Gauss-Kodazzi equation. And the Ricci scalar appears in the Einstein-Hilbert term, which is a total derivative in two dimensions. So I can use the Gauss-Kodazzi equation to eliminate one of the extrinsic curvature squared terms, and I can put one, and this one has a lot of boxes in it, so it appears at fairly high order if you compute the energy level, so I won't talk about it in the rest of the talk, but I'm happy to say more about it if people want. Okay, so far this is all classical. The only thing you need now to make it quantum is a regulator that respects the symmetries, and in this case, it's very simple. You just take this action and make this into a D. It's a little bit more subtle because really this only works for Onshell quantities in the most naive way. But roughly speaking, this is what you do. And then I just told you about these two extrinsic curvature squareds and the Gauss-Kodazzi equation that relates them to the Ricci scalar. Now in D dimensions, the Einstein-Hilbert term isn't a total derivative anymore. So I have to put that term back in. So I get this evanescent operator, and the claim is this is the effective theory you can use to compute whatever you want to compute for long strings. So you have just the Nambu-Goto term, then extrinsic curvature squared, and the Einstein-Hilbert term. For closed strings, you just compactify it. So you take sigma, make it periodic, and compute your energy levels. For open strings, you still have to worry about boundary conditions. Yeah?
Since this is perturbative in the extrinsic curvature, I guess you can't use this approach to study the intersection of two long strings.
Yeah, no, this is for one. It also breaks down if you have cusps, so there's many configurations where it's bad.
I have a second question. So in the context of cosmic strings, mm-hmm. at one point,
I have to say I don't remember what I don't know that work. What was the conclusion or what was the controversy?
So it's Keiichi Maeda.
Okay.
That's one group and the other is Ruth Gregory.
Okay.
You were wondering what is the leading term in this expansion?
In the next correction, you mean? The
already this is it
like here. Is it this or okay. And they were computing what? I mean, this, for instance, doesn't contribute. If you compute scattering amplitudes, this one doesn't contribute. It It vanishes on show.
Okay.
So some classical solutions. Okay. No, I don't know. I can look it up. Yeah.
Does it make sense not to expand the spiral?
Yeah, you should expand.
Eventually, when you are going to do computation, you do a gradient expansion.
Yeah, we expand. So this you should have thought of as, I didn't say, but this I'm thinking of as the expanded thing. So it's what I wrote before, just with the coefficients fixed. So this is an expansion in vertices. So when I compute scattering amplitudes, I compute the ones from the quartic interactions, and then there's higher order corrections from the sextic interactions and so on, but you should expand it out.
But is there a limit in which you can get everything out of this determinant and neglect? I mean, does it make sense to write it this way, or should I expand everything in parallel?
In practice, we expand everything here. In practice, when we compute, we do everything in a gradient expansion, so everything is expanded out.
And then
for example.
Okay, so whatever is in the square root, but it's higher than for the relative, is actually irrelevant.
Well, it depends on what you want to compute. I mean, say if you want to do 3-to-3 scattering, you need the sextic interaction also. So it depends also on the processes you study. What's the leading effect? Or I mean, then you just have both the sextic vertex contributing and two quartic ones. So it depends on what you're computing. Okay, so there was some confusion as to whether you should add non-covariant terms here. And I'll briefly explain why there might have been a confusion. There really shouldn't have been a confusion, I think. But let me briefly tell you how it's related to Polchinski and Strominger, and maybe why people were confused as to what the right action is in static age. But so what they do, I did everything in static age. They work in conformal gauge. So now we'll start just from the diffeomorphism invariant action and fix a different gauge. So I fix static gauge, they fix conformal gauge. In this case, what you want to impose is that the induced metric is proportional to eta alpha beta, which you can always do in two dimensions. And then the action becomes very simple, because this whole thing just becomes e to the phi. E to the phi is 1/2 the trace of this. So the trace goes here, you get the kinetic term, and you get the 1/2 here. Now, you also know that there's residual diffeomorphisms that you didn't fix, which are just conformal transformations. They leave you in the same gauge. And they're generated by the constraints. You see the constraints directly, because eta plus plus is 0. So these things have to be 0. So these are the constraints you have to impose. This so far is nice, but it only really works in 26 dimensions, because away from 26 dimensions, you have to keep track of the gauge fixing determinant. In principle, you can just do the exercise more carefully and derive what the gauge fixing determinant is directly at the level of the axis. What they did is they say, well, we really know what it looks like from the quantization of the string in the Polyakov action, and we set the Liouville mode, if you want. We set it to equal to this, and then you get an action that takes this form. This at first may look a little strange, but it's not really a problem, because this is only supposed to be used for long strings. And if you expand this out for a long string background, this is 1 plus something that's quadratic in the fluctuation. So you can expand it out, and it's all perfectly fine. Now, you might say this is not really a derivation. But what they did then is they said, OK, but what we do know is that we still have this residual conformal symmetry. And this means that the theory for the axis in the presence of this interaction has to have central charge 26 to cancel the central charge for the BC system. And they check that, and this is true. So the theory of the axis now has central charge 26, even though you're not in D equals 26. Now the question is, so here it seems you had to add this term that's proportional to 26 to the action. That's kind of funny looking. Does this mean you had to add something to the action in static age? And I think the short answer is just no. I mean, this was a gauge fixing determinant that you got because you went to conformal gauge. If you go to a different gauge, if you go to static gauge, there's no gauge fixing determinant. But to show this explicitly, what we did is we computed scattering amplitudes and compared them in the different gauges. What people did before, to some extent, was expanding out the action and comparing coefficients in different gauges. What you really, I guess, should do is compute physical observables and match them, either the energy levels or scattering amplitudes. So this is what we did. And this, essentially, I'm just going through for you because I'll compute later the scattering amplitudes on the critical strings. So maybe here you'll get some idea for why we computed these things and what they look like. Yeah? Yes, yes, you'll see the scattering amplitude is exactly the same, even though you didn't add anything proportional to 26. Yeah, that's the point of this computation. So, okay, let's start on the Polchinski-Strominger side, just in conformal gauge. And there, you see it's very simple to compute. It's just a tree-level diagram. So here you get a quartic interaction from. You just compute the tree-level diagram, and you get scattering amplitude from there. That looks like this. Now, let me just intuitively tell you what this means, I guess. What it means is if you have a string that's excited in the one direction, well, a left-moving quanta, a quantum, and a right-moving quantum excited in the one direction, when they meet, what can happen is that they turn into two quanta in the two direction. So the string goes from oscillating in the one direction to oscillating in the two direction. This is what I'll call annihilation. And then there's also the process that a quantum in the one direction comes in and one that's excited in the two direction, and they get reflected. That's this process, reflection. The process that doesn't happen from this amplitude is that the quantum that's excited in the one direction just passes through the quantum in the two direction and picks up a phase. This does not happen from this Polchinski-Strominger interaction. The interaction that's proportional to d minus 26 gives you annihilation and reflection. There's also interactions coming just from the constraints. They give rise to only transmission in their lower order. They go like S squared. I didn't write them, but we'll see them on the next slide in the static gauge. Okay, so now let's compute the same in static gauge, and let's start at tree level. So here there were two quartic interactions. One was the kinetic term squared, where the flavor indices are contracted in the same way as the derivatives. And then there was a second term where flavor indices were contracted in opposite ways from derivatives. And once you add them up with appropriate coefficients, in the conventions I had earlier, C2 is 1/2. And C3 is minus 1, then you get this amplitude, and you see that this only gives rise to transmission, and this is exactly the interactions you get from the constraints in the Polchinski-Strominger picture. Okay, now let's move on and try to see the d minus 26. So for that, we have to go to one loop. So let's compute the scattering amplitude and static gauge at one loop, and then there's a surprisingly large number of diagrams. I think it was something like 3 times 72 or something, but you can use crossing and you can simplify things. A lot of them in the end turn out to be the same. So it's at the end, it's not that bad, but it takes longer than you naively would have thought maybe. So I'm not drawing them all, but I'll only draw two simple ones and illustrate a simple point. So there's diagrams that in the large n counting go like d minus 2 because they have a closed loop in flavor space. And then there's ones that just are order 1. And you can see that you could get something that goes like d minus 26 from here at one loop in principle. Before we compute the finite parts, it's already interesting to look at the divergent parts because they tell you if your regulator respected the symmetry. For this, you can look at, these are the two possible counter terms. This one that sits in the Einstein-Hilbert term, which when you compute scattering amplitudes goes like STU. And then there's also a second term that I'll call non-covariant, and it in scattering amplitudes goes like S cubed, like the Polchinski-Strominger interactions, if you want. Non-covariant is maybe not a very good term because it does sit in the extrinsic curvature squared interaction. But what I mean by non-covariant is that the extrinsic curvature starts out quadratic in axis. And so if you wanted it to be generated, you also have to generate the piece that's quadratic in axis at one loop, which means this diagram should have given you something, and you know it doesn't because in dimensional regularization, these loops vanish. So if you generate this at one loop, then you didn't generate k squared. You just generated something that really was non-covariant, and so you're done. The symmetry is broken. But fortunately, if you do the calculation, you find that the divergent part indeed goes like STU. So you can cancel it with the Einstein-Hilbert term alone. Now, you might have guessed that somehow 26 is special in the sense that you don't need to worry about these counter terms. That doesn't turn out to be true. So this is proportional to d minus 8. I don't really think this 8 means anything, especially because this always vanishes when you restrict to 2D kinematics, because t times u in two dimensions is always 0. So this, at the end in two dimensions, is always gone. You just need it as a counter term away from d equals 2. Okay, so now you can compute the finite part. And you see, indeed, that at one loop, you just get the d minus 26 from the static gauge, the brute force static gauge one loop computation. And there's a term that again vanishes. I wrote it just for completeness. Then there's a term that vanishes in this channel, but it's important in the cross channel because it gives you the right imaginary part that you need for the optical theorem to work or for unitarity. Okay, so the conclusion is that you really don't have to add any extra terms in static gauge if your regulator respected the symmetry. If you pick a regulator that violates the symmetry, then you have to add non-covariant counter terms to ensure that your quantum theory really has the symmetry still. A different way of seeing that this makes sense, I guess, is to notice that this gauge fixing determinant, which is R1 over box R, is local in conformal gauge because R is something like box phi. So in that case, you can directly put it in the Wilsonian action, which is what happens in the Polchinski-Strominger case. And then in static gauge, it's not local, and it automatically appears in the 1PI effective action from a brute force computation.
Excuse me?
Yeah?
So what is the regulator that you use?
This was dimensional regularization. So instead of two dimensions, I work in 2 minus 2 epsilon. Here I didn't have an epsilon tensor. I mean, in the computation, there was no epsilon tensor. So all the interactions were, is this? Oh, well, let me just erase this one. So the vertices I'm using are only these two vertices. So there's d alpha xi, d alpha xi, and then d beta xj, d beta xj. And then there's the one that's d alpha xi, d beta xi, d alpha xj, d beta xj. So in those vertices, there was no epsilon. I think there's no epsilon, strictly speaking. At the end of the day, when you just expand it all out, there's always an even number of epsilons, which you can write in terms of eta's.
Okay, so it's the same as you do the algebra in two dimensions, if you have epsilon, and then you do
so. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this comes up later, but much later. I can show you. Yeah, there we use something like dr bar or something, where all the algebra for these things is like the two-dimensional one, and then you just continue your momentum integral. Yeah, so I guess in conclusion, from an effective field theory point of view, okay, there's this rational term that appears away from 26 dimensions. From the point of view of a two-dimensional theory, this is a big deal for massless particles because annihilation and reflection spoils integrability. So you only have a chance of the theory being integrable if you don't have this, which is in 26 dimensions. So in 26 dimensions, the Lorentz invariant theory is integrable away from 26. The Lorentz invariant theory is never integrable. Okay. So now we have the theory, and we can use it to compare energy levels. The first one you might compute is the ground state, which just has the linear piece. This is the piece that goes like 1 over r, because you have the d minus 2 free bosons at small r, if you want. Then you can compute the two-loop contribution. And there's things at three loops, and then there's non-universal higher order terms that involve the extrinsic curvature squares that I didn't compute and also didn't write, I guess. So now?
Is this expression that combines into the square root?
Yes. Yeah, to this order, this is all there is. There's only at the two slides up, there's one term that isn't in the square root. That's proportional to d minus 26. But in the ground state at this order, there's nothing that's not in the square root, so it's all universal. Yeah, so there's no d minus 26. And now you can fit it, and you find that it describes the data pretty well to this order. So I would say it's hard to see anything non-universal from here.
What's the parameter?
LS, the string tension. Well, there it's always given in terms of the lattice spacing. So it's just in practice what I did is fit one parameter to it. Maybe you can sort it out in a better way. I mean, in principle, they should know what it is. But I think they also say they measure it from the ground state. So if you have a different way of measuring this parameter, then I don't think you need this. But I don't know where to look. Okay, so the next state you can consider is just you have your string and then there's just one left mover or one right mover, which again doesn't yet probe annihilation, so you don't expect any d minus 26 and it's also not there. So you can compute them perturbatively and you can also, you do see that this just is the square root formula. And then you plot it again and you do okay until you get to R equals 2 roughly, and you say, okay, well, my derivative expansion just broke down somewhere around here. That's not so bad.
It's the same LS as you fit it from the previous.
Yeah, I fit LS from the previous slide, and then you might say you should fit LS from some global fit, but what I did is I fit it from the ground state, and then I use the same LS for all the other states. Again, there's no d minus 26. And then you look at a left mover and a right mover, and they eventually will scatter. And so there will be a contribution to d minus 26. And you see I have a plus minus here, so it splits different levels. So I should tell you what the levels are. So you have one left mover and one right mover. We're in four dimensions, so there's two transverse directions to the string. Let's call them 1 and 2. Then I can make an anti-symmetric wave function, 1, 2, -2, 1, or I can make a trace, 1, 1, +2, 2. Both of those have spin 0, and then I can make the traceless symmetric guy, which has spin 2, and it splits the spin 0 and the spin 2 states. The scalar and anti-symmetric ones go down because they have the plus, and the d is less than 26, so they go down, and the spin 2 state goes up. So now one would like to know how this does, or what the data does. And yeah, these corrections were computed also by Ofer, and this is presumably Sohar talked about these things, I think. But I don't know. And then it's a little bit disappointing because this is what the data looks like, and this is what the predictions look like. So clearly, you would say the naive derivative expansion only really works where there's no data, which is a little sad. I mean, qualitatively, you can say, okay, I see that the symmetric guy gets lifted by these interactions, this one goes down. But more than that, I'm not sure. So you can say, okay, we just have to wait until the data gets better. I'll try and explain that this is not the case. I think one can actually compute, and I'll say what the expansion is I'll be doing. It won't just be a derivative expansion. I'll be expanding essentially in the momenta of the quanta that make these states. And if people are interested, I made slides, but I'm not sure I'll get there, I guess. So, but I'm happy to talk about as long as you want to stay. Okay, so this was the first part, and now I'll tell you about the scattering, the S matrix on the critical string, unless there's more questions about the first part. Okay, yeah, so far we've looked at the scattering amplitudes on strings that are UV completed by some field theory, like QCD or some other SU engaged theory. Now you might ask, I mean, and we've also seen that the scattering amplitude was universal. It wasn't that there was any choice. This was there just because Goldstone bosons are never free. So what about critical strings that are UV complete by themselves? What is their, what do their scattering amplitudes look like? Can we compute them somehow? And it turns out we can. Now, in principle, you can compute it by fixing a particularly good gauge and just literally deriving it. What we did is somewhat different. We said, okay, we know the exact spectrum from the quantization in light cone gauge. So this is a bit of a funny symbol, but what I mean is I quantize the string in light cone gauge and compute the energy that's associated, or the conserved charge that's associated with translations along x0, so the static gauge energy. And I find that it looks like this, the square root formula you probably know. This is just the tension piece. These are the KK momenta, and this is because I added a bunch of particles. So this is winding one. Now, one thing you immediately see is that this is not a free theory. In a free theory, you would have said the energy of the n particle state should have been the sum of all the one particle states that make up the state, and this is clearly not the case here. There's no particle production, you can also immediately see from here, because the number operator commutes with the Hamiltonian, so these n's are all conserved. You also see that the energies only depend on the level, which I denote by n and tilde, I guess, which means that different SO2 representations are degenerate, which is also telling you that there's no annihilations and reflections, because we, for example, saw that in this state with one left mover and one right mover, the spin 2 and spin 0 representation of SO d minus 2 were not degenerate. They got split by annihilations. Here you do have degeneracy, so there's no annihilations and no reflections, so the scattering is very boring, if you want. There's only an overall phase. So now the question is, what's that phase? And it's easy to extract. I think this is something people who work on the lattice know well, and here I'm sure people also know well how to do this. What you want to do is you want to put your theory on a circle and follow its time evolution for some time t over r. And this time, because they move at the speed of light, they go around the cylinder halfway, or the circle. So you pick up one phase shift from the scattering. And you also know from the time evolution, you pick up a phase that's just e to the minus I times the time, which is r over 2, times the interaction energies. The interaction energy is just the energy difference between the state with 1-1 relative to the ground state minus twice the energy of an individual guy. So this is what I'm writing here. So this is just e to the minus I interaction energy times time. And so if you want to extract the infinite volume phase shift, you just take the limit as r goes to infinity of this expression and you keep p fixed, and you find that the phase shift looks like this, which is somewhat peculiar. So the phase shift is p left times p right, which may look to you somewhat gravitational, because if you look at iconal scattering, so scattering at high energies but large impact parameter, so you don't form black holes, you also get a phase shift that's p left times p right. So it's just proportional to the energies of your quanta that interact. So this is something you see here. Yeah, or here I just write it as the S matrix. So there's a piece where 1 goes to 3, so, and 2 goes to 4, and they just pick up a phase, and then there's the one where 3 and 4 are interchanged. I didn't strictly speaking prove it, but you can show that it factorizes, and this means the theory is integrable. Which, okay, might have been obvious to you from the beginning. But this S matrix agrees with our perturbative calculation to the order we've calculated, and it's factorized and reflectionless, but somewhat to our surprise wasn't discussed in the literature. There's really a lot of papers on these factorized reflectionless S matrices, but this wasn't discussed. And in a second, I can maybe explain why this is. Now, you might have worried, because I've been talking about S matrices in a theory of massless particles. Usually those are plagued by IR divergences. So why is this not a problem here? One is we didn't see any in our explicit calculation, but there's obviously a better reason for this. And the reason is that the theory is IR free. So usually the problem would be that your particles interact and then you have a bunch of left movers flying out, a bunch of right movers flying out, and the left movers can still interact. They can either emit soft quanta or they can emit collinear quanta, and you get all kinds of divergences. In this case, if you have left movers, they just don't interact anymore. There's no interactions in this theory between left movers. And a simple way to see it is just if you only have left movers, you can boost them and make them arbitrarily soft. And then because you only have derivative interactions, the interactions go to zero. So the interactions had to be zero in the first place. So this S matrix is well defined, even though it's for massless particles. And it's not unique. I mean, there's many examples of well-defined S matrices for massless particles. So I'll show you one other one in a second. So yeah, you might ask, how does it fit in? I mean, there's many papers on this, and Samolodchikov a long time ago showed that based on unitarity, analyticity, Lorentz invariance, and crossing, these S matrices or the phase shifts must be of this form, where this is defined in the upper half plane, so when the imaginary part is positive. When it's negative, you just flip all the S's, I mean, all the signs on S. And you have a branch cut all the way along the real axis when they're stitched together at a point because they're massless. And these poles have to be such that they're either on the imaginary axis or they come in pairs like this. And P has to be an odd function. So this is what it has to look like. And naively, you would say, based on locality, that P should be zero. Then the simplest S matrix you can write is this, just a single pole on the imaginary axis. And this looks very trivial, but it's already interesting physically. It corresponds to the 2D Volkov-Okulov-Goldstino theory, which nonlinearly realizes broken supersymmetry. So this is already a nice theory, and in particular, it describes the Archi flow from the tricritical Ising model, or the minimal model with central charge 7/10, to the critical Ising model. The IR, you can easily see, it flows to free fermions. That's the critical Ising model. And in the UV, you have the tricritical Ising model. And how to see this, I'll say in a second. A lot of you probably know this better than I do. So another remark one can make is that seemingly this theory is only valid up to M, looks like an effective field theory with some cutoff M, but really this UV completes itself. You don't need any new particles. This is UV complete by itself. So if you want, this is an example of asymptotic safety to some extent. And we'll see our theory is not of this form, but okay. So for us, what we had is the phase shift was just e to the is over 4, which is the simplest S matrix you can write that doesn't have any poles, and that's still polynomially bounded on the physical sheet. If you had put e to the is cubed, it doesn't work anymore, but this one is still okay. Now you might ask, well, does this describe an RG flow between two CFTs as well? It's pretty generic that these massless S matrices describe RG flows between different CFTs. And so let me briefly say how you would see it for the Goldstino theory. So the idea is that you can extract the central charge of the UV and IR CFT by computing energy levels of the theory on a small circle for the UV and a large circle on the IR. And there, the energies should look like this. So, and from this, if you can compute the ground state energy, assuming that this is unitary, this is zero, then you just can read off what the central charges are. In general, you don't know these energy levels, but you can compute them from the S matrix using the thermodynamic beta ansatz, and I'll talk about this just in case people are interested about the last part of the talk. Because in our case, we don't really need this. We already know the energy levels, and at best, we can use the thermodynamic beta ansatz as a check.
Mm-hmm. I mean, usually this kind of phase, if I go to rapidity, is just exponential of something which is pi over theta. This I can always add. Any function which is pi over theta, I can add to the S matrix. But usually it's not good because we want something which is neuromorphic.
You're saying, well, this is just really what you need to get these energies. So if you want to have an S matrix that does reproduce the spectrum of a string, on a circle, this is just the S matrix. So if you throw it out because you don't like this behavior in the UV, which may be fine. I'll show you later. The bootstrap doesn't work here, but the S matrix itself is still okay. But the once you solve the equations for the to get local observables, and you solve your Riemann-Hilbert problem, then it gets bad, because then you have e to the in rapidities e to the minus beta times e to the beta, and for imaginary part of beta equals pi, this really blows up. But the S matrix, I think, is not bad. It's still really bounded on the physical sheet, which is all I would usually ask. It has an infinity at an essential singularity at infinity, but I'm not sure that's, I don't know. I don't know. This is later on, I'll argue this is why you don't have local observables in that theory. So in that sense, it's good and bad, I guess. I mean, you don't want local observables in a string theory, and this is the reason, I think.
But yeah, usually there is a reason why we do not add this kind of stuff, because this kind of phase can add to any theory, and it will not change anything. I mean, it satisfies unitarity crossing.
Yeah, but it changes the physics. So if I just take out this phase and just put S matrix 1, then I have a free theory. I got a completely different spectrum. So it's not true that it doesn't modify anything. It's compatible with all the symmetries. It's a CDD factor. But
it's a CDD factor, except that usually by CDD factor, we mean a solution, a trivial solution, a homogeneous solution of the equation, plus the condition that it is meromorphic.
Mm-hmm.
So we exclude explicitly this kind of
thing, right,
which marginally we could have exponential of the periodic function of theta with any function.
Mm-hmm.
This is a huge arbitrariness. If we allow this, then we cannot predict anything.
Any I don't think you can have, because this is still polynomially bounded on the physical sheet. If you make it e to the is cubed, for instance, it's not, because it also blows up on the physical sheet. So this is one.
Square root of 1 plus S square.
Square, say again? Square
root of 1 plus S square.
No, it has to be odd in S. This function you add has to be odd in S. So what you can do in a massive theory, you can have e to the I sinh of theta or something like this. But I think it has to. One of the properties of this P was that it had to be odd. I mean, this doesn't prove anything, but well, we can look at it later. But this is one of the properties you get from unitarity, just because you want the product of the two to be one. So it has to be odd. So you cannot add the square root of 1 plus S squared, say. You could have added S cubed or something like this. Is that okay, or? Okay, yeah, for us, yeah, we already know the energy levels, so we don't have to go through the thermodynamic beta ansatz, and we can immediately check if this could have been described an RG flow between two CFDs. And here, it's important what you asked earlier. It doesn't go like 1 over R, it's small r. This you can see here, because the n, if you set them to 0, this disappears, and you see you have a negative sign here, so it goes to 0 at some finite value and then becomes complex. So the ground state becomes unstable, which I think you should associate with deconfinement in this case. But you can also look at the excited state, and you see that this term dominates at small r, which just is the absolute value of n minus n tilde, which also doesn't look like a CFT. In a CFT, it's important that the left and right movers decouple. So it should have been n plus n tilde, which it's not. And yeah, so this tells you that this theory really does not describe a flow between two CFTs. And in particular, even though it seems to be UV complete, because you can compute scattering and arbitrary energies, it's not controlled by some UV fixed point. You can also see this directly from the S matrix. Whenever it's supposed to be a flow between two CFTs, left and right movers have to decouple in the UV and in the IR, which means that the S matrix has to go either to plus or minus 1 in the UV and in the IR, but e to the IS goes to 1 in the IR, but in the UV you still have these oscillations, so it never approaches a CFT. So in that sense, it's quite a strange theory. Okay, Yeah, so we didn't need the thermodynamic beta ansatz, but I'll briefly go through it because I'll later use it for the flux tube spectra, and I didn't want to assume everyone knows it, even though surely some people here know it better than I do. But yeah, okay. So the starting point for now is, the question is, yeah, you have your S matrix, how do you get the energy levels? And let's first consider a large circle where you don't have to worry about interactions that go around the circle. Then you can say, okay, my energy should just be the vacuum energy plus, and then I've diagonalized my Hamiltonian, the energies are quantized, I can add one quantum, another one, a bunch of quanta, and the energy should just be the sum of all the energies of these quanta. The question then is, how are the momenta quantized, so I can figure out what the energies are. And to understand how they're quantized, you should just look at the two-particle or the n-particle wave function and demand that it's periodic. I'll look at the two-particle wave function because it's the simplest to explain, I guess, and then it's easy to see how it generalizes. So for the two-particle wave function, by which I mean this thing, you should just compute it for large r, and you will get something, or it also makes intuitive sense. So you look at a process where you have a left mover with flavor I going in and a right mover with flavor J going this way. And at x1, you measure flavor I, and x2, you measure flavor J. So if x1 is bigger than x2, you measure the flavor I and J before they interact. So it's just a free, two free particles. On the other hand, when x1 is less than x2, you measure them up here after they've scattered, so they've picked up a phase shift. Now you want to demand that this wave function is periodic, which means you want to say this at x1 plus r, because then x1 plus r is definitely bigger than x2. So this with x1 replaced by x1 plus r should be equal to this. From here, you just get e to the minus ip left times r, which is this. And then from here, this has to be equal to this phase, or if you want to take the log of the equation, this is how it's usually written. So you just get p left times r plus twice the phase shift you get from the single scattering event is 2 pi nr. Or if you have multiple scattering events, you just add up all the phase shifts you get from all the scattering events. So this is the beta ansatz. Now this was a little too naive because I've computed this wave function without taking into account finite size corrections. Often they're not so important, maybe because you have massive particles and they're exponential in the size of the circle, exponentially suppressed. For us, everything is massless, so one should really keep them. And there's a simple way to do it, and the idea is called the thermodynamic beta ansatz. I'll do it for the ground state and then just write the equations for the excited states. So yeah, the first idea is that you can compute the ground state energy from the free energy, which is just based on modular invariance if you want. So again, most people will probably know this, but so you have your theory on compactified on a circle R, and I'll make it Euclidean and also compactify it on a circle, on the time-like circle with length L. And then if I make L very large, I'm computing the partition function at finite temperature, but in the zero temperature limit. So I'm projecting onto the ground state. So I get my partition function in this limit takes this form. I can also, in a relativistic theory at least, I can take the same theory on a circle of length L and compactify in time with length R. That computes the free energy. And in the limit where L goes to infinity, I'm taking the thermodynamic limit where the free energy just becomes an extensive quantity and becomes linear in L. And then I can just use that I computed the same quantity and say the ground state energy is given in terms of the free energy density, like this. Now, I still don't know how to compute the partition function, so the next idea is to compute the free energy, not by computing the partition function, but computing the free energy from the beta ansatz, which is good because now I take the circle to be very large, so I can ignore the finite size corrections. The beta ansatz, now I have my right movers with flavor I. They pick up phases from scattering with the left movers. Instead of having individual left movers, I'll put some particle density here. So this is the density for finding a particle with flavor I with momentum between P and P plus dP. And I get, so this is what the beta ansatz looks like, the same with R and L interchanged. Now, I also still want to get rid of these individual particles, and I do this by looking at the level density, so how many levels I have. So I take the derivative with respect to this P, and this equation becomes a constraint that relates the density of particles to the density of states. So the more particles you add, the more you affect what your states do in the theory if it's interacting. Okay, so now the idea is to then write the free energy in terms of the particle densities and the density of states and minimize with respect to rho I, subject to the constraint that I just showed you, and you get an equation that looks like this. So the ground state energy is the cosmological constant we had for the string, and then plus these finite size corrections, where epsilon satisfies an integral equation. In this case, for the string, you see it's very simple because the only p dependence appears out here. So if you set epsilon to some constant times p, it becomes trivial to solve. And you find a quadratic equation for c. Only this solution is physical, and you find that the energy, the ground state energy, is this, which is in agreement with what we started with. Now, for excited states, it looks a little more complicated, but it's still easy to recognize what the pieces are. So here, this is the beta ansatz that we had earlier. And then we said we have to understand what the finite size corrections look like because we have interactions that go around the world. And now we know what they look like. So this is what the finite size corrections look like that we were missing earlier. Even the excited state is still very simple to solve because the epsilons are still linear in P, so you can still do the same trick. You get an equation that's easy to solve, and you find that the energy levels for the S matrix e to the is over 4 are given by this. So somehow e to the is knows a lot about all the energy levels. Okay. So now let me tell you a little bit about the properties of this S matrix. One, I already told you, there's no UV fixed point for that theory. You can see from the S matrix that there's a maximum temperature, essentially because computing the ground state energy already computed for us the free energy, and I'll show that in a second. There's a minimal length. There's a time delay that grows with the energy, somewhat reminiscent of black hole formation, where you have a time delay that goes like the energy cubed in 4 dimensions. And then, I guess because the whole bootstrap method doesn't work for this S matrix, this is one of the arguments why you might say there's no local observables. Also, just thinking of it from the point of view of string theory, not from the 2D 1 plus 1 dimensional field theory, you also know there shouldn't be any local observables. But that's a bit cheating. So here, how do you see that there's a maximum temperature? Well, you look at the free energy. This we know because we just computed the ground state energy, and we know by the arguments I just gave you that it's related to the free energy like this. And, well, I introduced this quantity, which is the Hagedorn temperature. From the free energy, you compute the heat capacity, and you see that the heat capacity and the integral diverge. So you need an infinite amount of energy density to really reach the Hagedorn temperature. Other amusing things you can compute is, for example, that the speed of sound vanishes for these quanta at the phase transition. You can also see that these strings have a Chaplygin gas equation of state. Now let me show you that there's a minimal length in that theory. So how would you do this? So you can look at the scattering of 2 quanta, so a left moving and a right moving quanta, and we'll trace out the right mover at a time much after this interaction. So we only ask how we see the left mover here. So we're asking what a detector overhear at late time Cs. And the density matrix that you get, if you assume that these are Gaussian wave packets, looks like this. This is the diagonal entry of the density matrix for this left mover. It looks like this, where you have a width that got broader because of the interaction. So the delta x left squared for a free theory would just be 1 over p left because it was a Gaussian wave packet. Here it got broader. And you can show, if you look at the left and right moving width, that they satisfy an inequality like this. So you can never probe distances that are shorter than LS in this theory, because if you try to make one of them, one of the wave packets small, the other one will get very broad. So you can never probe distances smaller smaller than LS with this S matrix. Now let's look at the time delay. That's also easy to read off from this density matrix. You just have to see how much longer you have to wait to see it in the presence of interactions from when you didn't have any. So this is just this piece. So the time delay for the left mover is proportional to the energy for the right mover. And in particular, it grows with the energy of the guy. You can also write it in the center of mass system. And there you see the time delay for the process grows with the center of mass energy, which is consistent, if you want, with the formation of black holes, where also you have a large time delay. Here it goes like a cubed, because 2 powers of it are the area of the horizon. Here the horizon is point-like, so it's consistent, the scaling between the two. Obviously, there's also many ways in which it's not like a formation of black hole, because you send 2 hard quanta in. For a real black hole, you would like to get a lot of soft quanta out. Here the theory is integrable, so if you send 2 hard guys in, you get 2 hard guys out. So in that sense, it doesn't look like a black hole. So it's really only the time delay. If you break integrability, maybe you can do something interesting, but we haven't been able to do that in a particularly clever way. So another thing you notice is that this satisfies some sort of equivalence principle. It's hard to see because I didn't show you the derivation, but it's true that this is independent of whether you study the scattering of this guy of 1 hard quantum or many soft quanta. So really, this only cares about the total energy the right moving blob carries. It doesn't care about what it was made of. And you'll even see this if you do the classical computation, which I briefly show you on the next slide. So for the classical origin of time delay, what you can do is you can have just a bump that moves to the left. So this is really a classical bump, which means you have some induced metric that looks like this, that you have your little right moving probe traveling in, and you can compute the time delay directly from this. And it's in agreement with a quantum mechanical answer. What's also curious, maybe also somewhat related to this being somewhat black hole-like, is that you see that as the right mover is inside the bump, it actually travels to the left. So if you want the light cones kind of tip over like in a black hole, but again, in many ways, it's also not like a black hole. So the absence of local observables would be nice to be able to make sharper. I guess one argument we have is that usually how you compute these local, the correlators, is using form factor techniques. So the idea is you start from the correlator, you insert a complete set of states, and then all you have to compute are these form factors, and you're done. And there are recursion relations for the form factors that in our case look like this, where this function f is a solution of the Riemann-Hilbert problem, that the solution looks like this. And here the e to the is is really problematic now. So here I'm not sure how to do it, at least in a unique way. Now this doesn't prove that there are no local observables, but at least the standard techniques definitely don't work for e to the is. Okay, so conclusions, I guess. I think this is as close to a gravitational theory as you might have hoped from a two-dimensional integrable model. Whether that's useful or not, I'm not sure. It would be nice if one could somehow break the integrability in a controlled way and really see something that looks a lot more like black holes with quasi-thermal spectra. So you send 2 hard guys in, get a lot of soft stuff out, but we haven't been able to do it. Another thing that I think is interesting is how you would see that 26 is somehow special just based on this S matrix. You should see that this S matrix nonlinearly realizes Lorentz, the target space Lorentz invariance only in 26 dimensions for the bosonic string, or only for D equals 10 for the superstring, where you still have the same phase, just the one is different, I guess, because now you have also fermions. It might be fun to just look at other exact solutions of string theory and play with this, but we haven't done that either. So this is all I had about these parts. And then if people are interested, I'm happy to talk about the computation of the flux tube energy levels. Otherwise, I can stop here. So it's up to whatever people are interested in, really. I'm happy to go on. It's up to you. Yeah. I don't know if people are still interested. I can talk about it, or I can quit. It's up to. Okay. It's not too much longer, I hope. Okay, so yeah, the idea was to, let's first, in this calculation of the flux tube energy levels, let's first look at the theory where we know the exact spectrum and see how the different ways of computing work. So let's look at this light cone theory, or the D equals 26 theory if you want, and let's consider the state again with one left mover and one right mover. And let's first just do the beta ansatz if you want. So let's not include any finite size corrections. Just the cosmological constant plus 2 pi over r. Then you get this red line. Now, in this theory, we also know how to compute the exact finite size corrections, and this is shown in the green line. And the important point is, I guess, that these exact finite size corrections are always corrections, so they're never large even at small r. And the naive derivative expansion breaks down here. So the question is if one can do this part better, I guess, for the flux tubes. And it turns out that you can. So the naive derivative expansion, I guess, is maybe just too naive. Okay, yeah. It's a bad idea to expand these finite size corrections for large r, in other words. Now, you might say, okay, I'm at very small r, so presumably I'm probing large momenta, and what I just said makes no sense, but this is not really true, because we know exactly what the finite size corrections look like. So this was the one without finite size corrections, and then the finite size corrections we know look like this, and they're not really probing the UV, because they look very thermal. So I'm showing here the integrands that appear as a function for r of 1.5, which is smaller than what I'll be interested in practice, because all the lattice data goes down to about 2. And you see that still the integrals are dominated by soft modes. They're not dominated by the hard modes, even though I'm on a small circle. So I'm not really probing the UV. It's true that here I'm making a mistake, but this is a relatively small effect. I think it's more important to capture this part correctly and kind of make a small mistake up here. Now you might ask why this should work at all for flux tubes in 4 dimensions, because those theories clearly are not integrable, but they are integrable at least at low energies when you can expand in the interactions proportional to D minus 26. I mean, those give you annihilations and reflections. At linear order in those theories, it's still okay. At second order, it doesn't work anymore. So as long as you're comfortable expanding in interactions that go like D minus 26 to first order, you can use this. And the second thing that makes integrability break is that there are also massive modes on these strings. And if you're at energies high enough, or if your quanta have momenta high enough so you can produce these massive states, then it's also bad, because you don't then just have two-to-two scattering, so there's not just processes like this, but by Lorentz invariance, there's also processes like this, and you just really break the integrability. So you now have 2 to 4 amplitudes. But as long as you're at energies low enough so that neither the d-26 interactions have to be taken into account to second order, nor you form these resonances, then I think the integrability is still there because you're in some sense close to this integrable theory that we just discussed. So here then you see if you have no windings, this is the answer, which doesn't do so badly with the lattice data. If you include the windings with the phase that we had before, you get this. And then the derivative expansion is shown here that just breaks down at 2. Here for this state, it's not so dramatic, but for the next state, we'll see it really is a big effect.
Just a second. So the middle curve, is it this square root for the light cone, for the light cone string curve?
The middle curve is essentially the square root for the light cone string. Later on, there's other winding corrections that we include in.
So you can just take the free string, quantize it as in Green Schwarz written, and you get the perfect answer.
Yeah. So there are corrections to this from the d-26 terms that you should take into account to the orange curve, but there are corrections to the corrections. I mean, they do affect exactly what this integrand looks like. But other than that, the more important thing is that you just don't expand these things here. So now let's look at this level again with one left mover and one right mover that looked very disappointing earlier. And for this level, what you can do is if you compute your phase shift, so we always work in an expansion. We never really use the e to the is, but we just expand the amplitude also in the thermodynamic beta ansatz. I'm not literally using e to the is, but I will expand my amplitudes because I'm really not probing the high energy physics. So in the thermodynamic, so here I use the one loop amplitudes and also expand them in the thermodynamic beta ansatz, and I show everything up to momenta of 1.8, which means I'm not showing anything beyond here, which, okay, this wouldn't be good anyways. But you see, for example, that all the, why it's 1.8 will become clear in a second, but you also see that the momenta here are never really large. So even though you go down to fairly small r, you're not really probing large momenta for this state. So this, you really still have at least some sort of theoretical control over. And yeah, but there's also these red points that now are very confusing because they're really way off any line. And you see that they're essentially just a straight line, which means that these are just a massive state. This was also pointed out in the people who did the numerical analysis. So they also said this looks a lot like a massive state. And in our case, you can also really see it nicely as a resonance, though I haven't made the plot. But if you plot the scattering phase shifts that you get from this state, you see that it's really a resonance. And so the question is, how do you include this massive state? And this is also not too hard because what we really need, so this is a resonance. What we really want to know is how it affects the scattering phase shift of the Goldstone bosons. And to compute it, we just put it in the action and couple it to the axis, just as an effective field theory. The massive state, we know what the symmetries are. It was the anti-symmetric state. Is the anti-symmetric tensor. So it should be anti-symmetric in I and J. And because it's anti-symmetric in I and J, you can also write this coupling to the axis. And you should dress all of these things. So there's square roots of the determinant of the induced metric and things like that I'm suppressing, but they're all higher order, so you don't have to worry about them for now. So you can write down this action and then just compute what the contribution is of this particle to the scattering of two x's. So from this you see that two x's can make a phi, and in particular the anti-symmetric guy produces this in the S-channel as a resonance. And this means in the S-channel you want to include this contribution to the phase shift. It's not just including a naive resonance. You're also, from the computation you see, or from this vertex you see, that there should be an s cubed in there because you have a large number of derivatives on each vertex. And if you didn't put this, it also wouldn't really fit the data. But if you include this, as well as the perturbative non-resonant contributions from the state, and you pick the mass, 1.8, and the width, so those were the two parameters you had in the Lagrangian, the mass and the coupling, then you find these kind of fits, and they're much better, I would say, than the fits one had before. And here, it's very hard to see, but this discrepancy of the red line with the points, I think we also understand, because there is diagrams where that shift the mass of this guy. I mean, the mass we took as a constant, but really there's diagrams like this that give you something like m squared goes to m squared minus some number divided by r squared, and this number is fixed in terms of gamma, and once you plug those values in, also these work better, but I haven't had a chance yet to make the proper plots. Yeah?
So this resonance exists only because we have this more than 26?
Because we have...
For the critical string, this resonance is absent.
Yeah, for the critical string, I guess you just only have the axis. There's no massive
states.
So
there is no bound state.
I mean, this is QCD. I'm not sure this would be there in the A and O string. I think this is, I'm not totally sure. It would be interesting to understand better why there is. So this is a state with spin zero that's parity odd. I'm not sure why that's the lightest massive string on a lightest state on a string world sheet in QCD. It's there in both the SU3 and SU6 data. So I don't think it depends much on N. But yeah, everything I'm showing is still from the beginning, the SU3 data. And yeah, for what's different from the critical string also, these levels should be degenerate. So these really are split essentially because of Polchinski's, because of D-26 interactions. The green and the blue, and the red one just wouldn't be there. It's also in three dimensions, they can do the same numerical studies, and there they don't find these. So in three dimensions, apparently, it's not there. But I don't know yet why. And yeah, this is all I had, I guess, about the energy. So even though the flux tubes are not particularly long, at least some of them seem to be under theoretical control because the momenta of the quanta are not that large. And it may even be that the data is already good enough to see the 26, but I also haven't yet had a chance to do that fit. It might be interesting to understand that state from the point of view of the gauge theory. I'm not sure what it is. And all this stuff is not unique to closed strings. So you could also do it to open strings, maybe try and reproduce mesons, but I'm not sure. I'll probably have to give them some spin because otherwise they're too short. But yeah, anyway, so this is all I really had. So thanks. Yeah.